The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Greetings and salutations. Welcome to episode 66 of The Commentary Track. I'm your amiable host, Frank Thompson. An American Tragedy, just looking for its place in the sun. This episode is the result of a screw-up. Unlike most of my screw-ups, I'm glad that this one happened. And here's how it happened. Long, long ago, back when the Earth was young and I was starting this podcast, I made up a list of people I wanted to have as guests. And one of the first people on that list was Marilyn Moss. I just finished reading her biography of Raoul Walsh, and I liked it very much. Then I went back and read her biography of George Stevens, and I liked the cut of her jib, and I thought she wrote beautifully and had real insight into both of those guys. And in the case of Walsh, I don't want to sound sexist here, because I hope that I'm not, but it surprised me that a woman would take on such an Uberman. Walsh was one of those real he-men directors, and I think the result turned out great. She had real insight into him and his films, and it's a delightful read. I highly recommend it. I called her up and asked if she would be willing to be a guest on this show, which wasn't even running yet, so she had no idea what it would be like or what the quality would be. But she said yes, and I went over to her place, and we had a wonderful talk, and I just got a kick out of it. So I got home, and I had just bought a new recorder, a Zoom R16, if you're keeping score at home, and it records on a little memory card about the size of a huge thumbnail. And I got home, plugged it in, started to transcribe it, and there was nothing there. There was nothing on that memory card, and I was crestfallen. I'm not even sure what my crest is, but it was fallen. It was fallen to the floor, and I tried everything I could think of to, because I knew that I had recorded this. I had been looking at the little volume gauge going all the way through it. I knew that it was recording, but it wasn't there. So, with shame in my heart, I didn't call Marilyn. I emailed her because I just couldn't face saying this aloud. But I wrote to her and I said, somehow I have lost the interview. Mea culpa. Would you be willing to do this again? Very graciously, she said that she would be willing to do it again the following week. The next Saturday, I went back over to her house and we talked again. Although it was certainly about Raoul Walsh and George Stevens, the conversation is still different. Because even instinctively, there was just something I just hate about chewing my cabbage twice. You know, I don't want to repeat myself if I can help it. And in this case, I just instinctively guided the conversation in different ways. So she tells some of the same stories. The upshot is that a while later, I was going through and checking some of the memory cards, and I plugged one in because there was nothing written on it. And there was the first interview. It was right there. The first thing that came up. How this happened, I will never be able to adequately explain. All I know is that it was not there, and then it was. So then what I had was two interviews with Marilyn Moss. Luckily, she's so interesting and so in charge of those subjects and so knowledgeable about film history in general that I didn't mind having two interviews with her. I just thought, well, I'll just hang on to one, and a long time from now, I'll plug it in. So since it has been perilously close to 2 years since that first one ran, and if you're an original listener, you listened to her first one a long time ago. Of course, if you're brand new, you might have listened to her first one yesterday. Who knows? Anyway, I decided to run the other one. I listened to it all the way through. And this is, I'll give you a little insight into the technical process. I always record these, then I go through, and I don't edit much. I'll mostly only edit if somebody belches or a phone rings and it just takes us out of it and we have to say, oh, should we get that? Oh, I don't know. Because I don't see any reason to make you listen to that kind of stuff. And I say, a lot. It bothers me, and I'm never aware of it so much as when I'm listening to myself saying, so, what do you think about Raoul Walsh? Because I just sound like a dummy. And I know what you're saying. I sound like a dummy most of the time, but this is rough. So I will go through and cut out some of my uhs. It might not be honest, but I feel better about myself when it's when some of that stuff is trimmed out. But in this case, I just put this one in to listen to it straight through because I haven't listened to it since we originally recorded it. And so I put it in to make sure that everything was okay and didn't make a snip, not one. I just listened to it for an hour and 25 minutes, and it was totally fascinating. I have interviewed people who don't know how to stay on the subject. I'm not going to point fingers, but you know what I mean. There are people who just can't tell a story without backtracking, without circling around the barn, and you have to sort of keep them on track. And sometimes I will end up doing a little snipping here and there just to make them seem less like lunatics. This interview with Marilyn was just perfect. And everything she had to say was a gem. And I was just so impressed with how well this went. And having recently listened to the first one, how different this is from that one. Although, there, as I say, there's a couple of stories that get told twice because I didn't want to risk the possibility of losing some of these stories, like the John Barrymore's corpse story. For example, I hope that you will enjoy this one and don't think that it's redundant because I don't think that it totally is. I think it's a treat and I really enjoy talking to Marilyn. I think you will really enjoy listening. So here's my talk with Marilyn Moss and I'll see you on the other side. I envy guys like Walsh and Wellman to be studio directors. It's because they're dead and their troubles are over.
Yeah.
But
they always had the paycheck coming in.
Yeah, they well,
not when you lived like that.
Their next projects were just given to them. I mean, to a certain extent, they had enough power to find things themselves. Yeah, we're going. Yeah. So
until a certain point, then after Walsh was no longer under long-term contract with Warner Brothers, which ended in the early 50s, the long-term contracts. Then he had to scramble, too. Not like today.
Yeah.
But he would sign one picture deals with this studio, with that studio, and kind of, juggle them. Because he went over to Universal. He was... I think he went back to MGM for the Leslie Caron, Ralph Meeker film, Glory Alley. But yeah, things he even talked about that he was freelance in the 50s and kind of tried to compensate for the fact that he wasn't too happy about it because he knew that it was nearing the end of his career.
Those guys, Walsh, Wellman, Hawks, Ford, all of their careers ended pretty much as the studio system was going away. So none of them really had to live in that independent world for too long, that freelance world. I keep hearing film directors being interviewed, and they always say, when somebody asks them something like, how do you choose your next project? They'll always say, well, you're going to have to live with this thing for at least 2 years, so you got to be very careful because the whole process takes that long to get it developed and made and all that. And I thought, you look at 1930 to 33 for Wellman, he directed 20 features. He didn't have 2 years to work on these things.
A couple of weeks.
Yeah. But the difference was is that they did the studio system backed them up. And so to a certain extent, mm-hmm. things were rolling with or without them. And it was a different world in that respect.
I think for Walsh, when he became firm, at Warner Brothers, his problems were always, how do I get let go to do a picture at some other studio? How do I get myself, because this very second film he did after he did The Roaring Twenties, the next film he did was for Paramount. I'm sorry, was for Republic, Dark Passage. So how do I get, how do I go and do this other film that I really want to do? And, but Walsh's famous quip always was, Well, I would, you know, go to bed one night, and the next morning, after I just finished the picture, there would be a script thrown on my front lawn like the L.A. Times. You know, and then you'd go to work. And he said that about Griffith. He said that about Warner Brothers. And he said that about Fox, because that's, you're right, that's the way it happened. Once they supported him. And once William Fox realized how much money he was making for him in the late teens, he just considered him his top dog, along with Ford and several others. And as Walsh said, lots of good scripts came down the pike, and that lasted for quite a while. Yeah, at least 5 years.
Well, when the studio system was working right, they had such a good sense of what director would be good for what film. Mm-hmm. And so it was unlikely that Walsh was getting assigned to something that he would just throw up his hands at and say, "What? Do you want me to do the next Blondie?"
There were a few of them. There were a few. There was The Horn Blows at Midnight, which he just took because they gave it to him. And I think it was Richard Erdman, who I spoke to, who wasn't in the film but was on the set, said, well, he was the wrong guy for that film. And a lot of people like it, but a lot of people think it's uncharacteristic and that he may have been the wrong director and he may have ruined it. He might have had a lighter touch, although he had a pretty light touch, but he wasn't a comedy director, per se.
Yeah, there
his comedy
few,
was different.
Very few of his films could actually be called comedies. Some of them had comedic elements, he didn't really do screwball comedies or anything like that.
And then another one that seemed unlikely was The Man I Love with Ida Lupino, which was really a woman's picture, a melodrama.
Yeah.
And he took it, I think, you know, probably because it was the late 40s and maybe things were just kind of slowing down a little until White Heat came along. But it was Ida Lupino, and he loved working with Ida. They were good friends on and off the set.
Yeah. Well, she was, she must have been great to work with, I would think. I mean, she was in one sense because she seems to have been so intense about it and so dedicated to it. I don't think she treated herself like a movie star, but she really treated herself like an actress.
No, she didn't. She showed up every day on time, and if she was sick, there was a good reason for it. It wasn't the way Walsh had to handle Errol Flynn, get him to the studio by actually picking him up in the morning. No, Ida was a hard worker and very serious about her craft, which, as we know, blossomed into a directing career later on. And she was tough. She was a tough cookie with a real vulnerability, just the perfect Walsh woman. Not as tough as Jane Russell, because they don't come as tough as that.
Sure.
On or off screen. Because Jane, I think, was the ultimate Walsh female. But Ida was pretty up there. She was pretty close. So they did actually, how many films? Three or four films together? Starting with They Drive by Night, where Ida really stole the film. By what Walsh called appearing in the plot that sideswiped the original plot, which was actually the story of George Raft and his brother Humphrey Bogart trying to make it in the trucking business and having nothing but bad luck and hard knocks. And then along comes Ida and does this Betty Davis psycho on the stand business, which people have noticed is a rehash of Betty Davis, although I forget what film it is right now.
She does tend to go full bore when she wants to to emote. I think that was even Betty Davis didn't quite go to the heights of hysteria that Ida Lupino was capable
of. Not on screen. But Walsh did have his episode with Betty when he directed the last scene in This Our Life, when John Huston mysteriously had to leave the set. And Walsh had to go out to Pasadena and direct Betty in the scene where she finds out that she killed she's involved in a car accident, and it's a hit and run. She kills someone, and she finds out that she's going to have to go to jail, or that she's going to have her comeuppance and be taken into the police station. And so it was a tough couple of weeks for Walsh, because she wanted it her way. And he wasn't used to people not listening to him. But Walsh has lots of different versions of his story, of how he talked to Ida to let her know what the script was going to be, and it wasn't going to be to her liking. One of the stories has him taking her out to dinner in Pasadena at a restaurant, which I guess wasn't that famous, because what in Pasadena was that famous at that time, but getting her a little chicored and then showing her the script. And according to him, she just, you know, talked like a sailor, yelling and screaming all over the restaurant, even embarrassed him. But that's just his story. But, of course, in his versions, all of the versions, he wins, I think in truth it was really more of a compromise. But it caused Jack Warner a couple of extra nights of not sleeping.
Now, how did you get – we'll go back a little bit later and talk about Stevens, George Stevens, who you wrote your first biography of. But your most recent book is on Raoul Walsh, and I can't think of two more disparate directors in many ways. But tell me how you got interested in Walsh.
I always knew the name Walsh. Even when I was a literature student and not a film student, I knew the name Walsh, and I was greatly intimidated by the name. It had this great sound to it, Raoul Walsh. Wow, all these great films. Although I didn't know any of them per se when I was very young, but I got to know his films more and more as I became more interested in film. And one afternoon I was watching White Heat, and I was just taken. I was bowled over by the energy, the masculine energy. It was very seductive, and I thought, I've got to know more about this guy. And I realized there was no biography, and that was when I decided to do it. I didn't know much about him, you know, when I started. And plus, I had a handicap in being female, because I think most people would consider Walsh a man's subject. But, you know, I when I saw White Heat, that was the defining moment. Yeah, when I decided. And the problem with Walsh is that he had no collection except at Wesleyan, which I'm sorry to say wasn't really cataloged very well. And so I did go back there and work. But otherwise, it was just a five-year period of amassing an enormous amount of information, as opposed to the ease with which it showed up when I was doing George Stevens, because everything he owned was in the Academy Library as a gift.
Did you find a lot of Walsh's co-workers had survived? Did you get to talk with many of them?
No, not many had survived at that point. But I was able, through the good graces of people like John Gallagher, was able to get hold of interviews that had been done with people before they did die, before they passed away, such as Walter Pidgeon. I think he spoke with Claire Trevor, lots of people, at least a handful of people, who really helped me understand Walsh. But it took a very long time to understand who he was and what it was he was trying so hard, I thought, to hide. Or not hide, but to run from or kind of defer from. And he was not a man who liked his innards to be known, you know. George Stevens was like that, but Walsh was trickier. So it took a while. But I you know, believe in the adage that you're going to see the man in his films. And I know that Ruben Mamoulian and Fred Zinnemann would back me up on that, from wonderful quotations I've read from their own books or their own interviews, things I've heard, especially Mamoulian say, which I truly believe, which is that every film is a director's autobiography in some fashion. And even if you see a director trying to defer or trying to hide, I think you can still figure out the psychology by knowing that he's doing that, or you get to know him a little better. So I had to look at a lot of the films to find the man, but I was also able to find a lot about the man. So I was fortunate, but it took a lot of doing because it was dispersed, the information.
I suppose you read his autobiography first thing?
Oh, yes. I never consider a subject's autobiography anything but fodder for a biography. Yeah. I don't ever take it as truth. If there are facts in it that are true, then that's great. My first autobiography ever that I worked with was Paul Bowles, the writer Paul Bowles, and he's a very good subject because he taught me a lot about autobiography, and that was that he tried to cover up any kind of self-explanation or self-exposure in the autobiography by taking on different personas. So I learned really well from Bowles, and when I read Walsh's autobiography, I realized I had to respect the amount of respect that he had for tale-telling, you know, for being a confidence man, so to speak. Narratively, he was always shape-shifting and all of that. So that was my first inkling into his psyche.
I've been formulating this theory that probably trash, but I think about it, that we almost always have to explore the myth of something before we can find the truth of something. And I was appalled to learn from a school child some time ago that they no longer teach, for instance, that George Washington cut down a cherry tree and then told the truth about it. Because I think these myths that we learn are so important to get us into the truth of a matter.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems a real shame to ignore them. And in some ways, I look at books like Walsh's Each Man in His Time, or Wellman's Short Time for Insanity. Frank Capra's book is filled with lies. Almost all these guys, just total lies that they... Not total lies, but total glosses on the truth.
Yeah.
And yet, somehow it finds making... Somehow it makes finding the truth about something more satisfying when you go through that doorway somehow. I don't know what...
Well, in a way, even though they are embellishments, I don't call them lies, because Walsh really believed that he was, I think, sometimes telling things that were true. They were embellishments. They were imagination for him. And I think that... understanding them is the quickest way to understand who your subject is. The lies I tell about myself. Isn't that a line from something? lies my father told me. But that to me is the first inclination of who that person is when you see what that person is creating about him or herself. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And... At some point in the biography of Walsh, I had to make the decision to respect the lie, the embellishments, that I had to respect them, and I had to include them. And there were some of them that were impossible to get to the bottom of, like the one about Barrymore's body.
Yes, we need to talk
impossible.
About that in some depth, but yeah, go ahead.
There's still, you know, even Walsh himself told versions of it after his autobiography. And as much research as I've done, I couldn't find any paper trail or anyone who was alive anymore. But even if I had found someone who was alive, I wouldn't probably have believed him anyway.
Sure. tell that story, because I've always loved it, and I've always wanted to believe it's true, even though I don't.
Yeah, but you love the fact that he tells it.
I do. I do love the fact.
And that it was corroborated by more than one person.
Yes, and I love hearing it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. Walsh was, as we know, very, very close to Errol Flynn. And he was, and here's, this is just one version, because there are many. He was at Errol Flynn's house, and Flynn was bemoaning the fact that he would never see his dear, dear, dear friend, John Barrymore, sitting at his dining room table anymore because John Barrymore had just passed away. So Walsh said, well, maybe he'll be sitting there just one more time. He said this to himself, drove himself downtown to the mortuary, and the way Walsh tells it in some of his versions, he knew the attendant on duty that night because the guy had been a silent screen actor in some of Walsh's silent westerns, probably some that he worked on at Griffith, at D.W. Griffith's studio. So he paid the guy a couple of bucks and said, can you let me borrow the body for a while? And the guy said, sure. So he took it.
Well, who wouldn't say sure?
Yeah, take it. So he took it, and I guess he had a station wagon. I don't know, but not necessarily. Anyway, he then, for some reason, just by some miracle, I guess, Flynn wasn't in the dining room when Walsh showed up. So he showed up, and he got, I guess there were other, according to what version you're listening to, there might have been others, such as Ralph Bellamy, who were in on it and carried the body with Walsh and propped it up at the dining room table on one of the chairs. And in walks Flynn and sees John Barrymore sitting there and just panics and almost has a heart attack. So that's one version. There are many versions where Walsh just says he took the body on his own, he saw it there. But, you know, I mean, these are all embellishments, or that he did it on his own. And then Walsh even makes the myth murkier by saying that, well, I wasn't really going to talk about it, except that Flynn talked about it in his autobiography, My Wicked, Wicked Ways. So otherwise, I was going to keep mum on the whole episode, but I decided that since he let the cat out of the bag, I might as well also.
So we have two very credible sources who tell us the story.
Yes.
So why shouldn't we believe it?
Right.
I keep trying to go through the logistics of how that would happen, and I reach stumbling blocks all along the way, but let's accept it, shall we?
Well, you know, I don't think Barrymore was a big man, and Walsh wasn't that tall. He was under 6 feet, or maybe near 6 feet, depending.
Well,
a lot older, you got a lot shorter, but not terribly. Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, according to Walsh, he would be able to put him over his shoulder.
And the body must have still been kind of limber to be able to
not full of formaldehyde. I don't know. I'm trying to think about that.
Yeah, we have to go through a lot of okay.
Or maybe he actually had the coffin. Who knows?
You know?
Well, I don't know why a station wagon comes to my mind, but anyhow, so he had the box. Perhaps, I don't know.
Tell me a little bit about Walsh as an actor. I've always wondered, because if he would have continued acting after he did, if the accident hadn't happened. First, what do you think about that? And then let's talk about the accident, because he only had one eye for most of his life.
Yeah.
And we could tell people how that came about.
Okay, well, Walsh was, he began as an actor, and he was an actor for Griffith when he worked for the Pathé brothers, but he was also an actor for Griffith and very quickly became an assistant director for Griffith. And Walsh always said that Griffith probably offered him some work as an assistant director because he knew what a lousy actor I was. That was Walsh's way of, you know, Walsh always was very self-detrimental sometimes. I think there was something in Walsh that he felt he had to apologize for himself a lot, even though that doesn't gel with the way he was able to go ahead with the career and just, you know, as with directors, have to make decisions immediately. But there was a self kind of put down, a self put down to Walsh at times. So a little quip about that. But Walsh was in front of the camera for a good number of Griffith films, and then he became an assistant director at Griffith and continued to stay behind the in front of the camera, and acted in was playing Pancho Villa when they decided to do the life of Pancho Villa and go down to Mexico to Juarez. He played Pancho Villa, but I think as he became more enamored of directing, which he loved to do, because there would be much more opportunity for him to go on an adventure as a director than as an actor. And he loved the adventure of travel, and that was a big part of his love of directing. So I think he got in front of the camera less and less. And you see him, the last time you see him in front of the camera with both eyes is Sadie Thompson with Gloria Swanson. Okay, so what happens then in 1928, Walsh is still slated to be director and actor in old Arizona. And
playing the Cisco Kid.
Yes, that's why I was getting confused, because I always think of it as the Cisco Kid. And he was on location with his wife. They were driving a Jeep.
Where were they
Utah.
Shooting?
They were shooting in Utah, near St. George. And he was driving the Jeep home one night and didn't see a rabbit in the road. Smashed into the rabbit, and the rabbit's body, now deceased, flew through the windshield and into the back seat, and upon doing that, shattered the glass in the windshield, and the glass splintered and flew into Walsh's eye. And he didn't lose the eye right away. They tried to save it. He was taken to Salt Lake to the hospital, and then they put him on a train to New York, and he eventually had to lose the eye. So I can't imagine that didn't kill his acting career. He probably had a lot of feelings about losing his eye that he never verbalized to anyone. It was traumatic enough as a director, let alone as an actor. So what happened was Irving Cummings took over the direction of In Old Arizona, and Warner Baxter took on the part of the Cisco Kid and won an Oscar for it. So I don't think Walsh cared too much about the Oscar. But anyway, that was the end of his acting career. And whether or not it meant that much to him, I think it meant less to him than directing.
Did they have to reshoot everything that Walsh has done, or is there any of Walsh's?
No, there are a lot of Walsh's long shots. There are a lot of Walsh's establishing shots. There's a lot of footage left that they used, but nothing of Walsh actually in the film.
Yeah. It wasn't too long after that that he directed The Big Trail, which was shot in what was called Fox Grandeur, which was actually a 70mm process, wasn't
right.
it? And so not an anamorphic process like CinemaScope, but actually a widescreen mm-hmm. process. But mm-hmm. When you look at that and see the composition and the depth and all that.
And the scope.
Yeah, and think that a one-eyed man had directed it is kind of amazing.
With monocular vision, as they call it.
Yes.
Whose depth of field was severely limited, or at least he wasn't used to it, and the other eye hadn't compensated yet. It was still too soon. And when you think about the enormous task of directing that film and traveling through seven states with wagon trains, horses, extras, animals, pigs, chickens, and John Wayne and Marguerite Churchill and El Brindle. And Ward Bond was in that that film. That was John Wayne's doing. He asked if his friend Ward Bond could join him. So it was an amazing physical task to accomplish. And when you look at the film, it is so, I like to say, American in the way it looks. I mean, it has to be, it's on the frontier, but it really dives into so many American myths, you know, cultural myths, And I think I mentioned this talking to you before, that John Wayne is, I think, the first visual embodiment we have, manifestation we have of the enduring myth of the of leather stocking, of Cooper's leather stocking, of the natural man who just kind of springs up from the earth, which is as pure as he is, the man without a history, who just kind of arrives on the scene, not laden, not burdened down with history the way a European protagonist would be, but someone who just kind of materializes. And there is John Wayne, who just simply materialized by Walsh's seeing him on the Fox lot as a, well, he was an extra. Walsh doesn't say whether or not he ever saw him as an extra, but he was an extra in Ford films. He says he saw him in the carrying props and told him to go, I think, to wardrobe and get a buckskin suit and keep his hair long, and he would see what he could do. But John Wayne is, at that point, not much of an actor, but you can see the grace, the beauty.
Sure.
It's all there.
He was a beautiful man.
Beautiful.
At that time. And he does, as you say, he does seem to just spring full-blown as John Wayne. I mean, his acting is not what it would be. I go against the tide of all these people who say that he was a great personality but not a great actor. I contend that he was a great actor.
Yes, I agree.
And one of the greatest film actors that we've ever had.
Which, yes.
And but he also had the additional gift of just this presence that is not something that you can study and acquire. He just had it, and it's right there in the big trail right away.
Yes. Yes, it is, and I think I agree with you. I was looking at The Searchers last weekend, and I was just mesmerized again by his presence, not only the beauty of the film. And one thing I didn't remember, I don't know why it skipped my mind, but or slipped my mind, Max Steiner wrote that incredible score.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot believe the work that Max Steiner's done. That's a story for someone else. But that was a beautiful score, and it was so, there was so much of John Wayne in that score. He must have been looking at Wayne when he wrote that. I can't imagine anything so you know, symbiotic with John Wayne, that beautiful score. And I think John Wayne was just embodied all of the sinisterism and the cynical, you know, the cynicism, and yet still the purity of a character that John Wayne has always symbolized. And I think that is a kind of cinema acting that you don't know, you don't get from studying. It's just something that happens, and it hasn't happened all that often.
No. One of the things that made him so successful is also one of the things that I think has kept people from taking him completely seriously as an actor, is that he did decide pretty early on that he would embody a certain kind of person. And he did go from very good characters to very, at least in The Searchers, at the very best, a conflicted character. Not really a bad man, but he's pretty close to being a bad man. And but there's still certain qualities that he always insisted on playing. I think had he just considered himself an actor and not a personality, he could have played, you know, can't you see him at 60 playing Willie Loman? Of course he could have, you know. He could have done anything. He could have done O'Neill or, and just, but I think because he, and I think it was a conscious decision to be a certain kind of character.
And I think what I know, I think that decision, that character was a really good tool to, ward against some insecurities that he always had from his childhood, and that he was terribly sensitive about feelings of unworthiness, like any kid has, you know, and that was his particular response to it. And I think it was very, very important for him to keep up that persona on and off screen. Yeah, and I think that is why I'm sorry he didn't do more films with Walsh, because I think they shared that. Yeah. But getting on to another actor, I have to say this before I don't remember it anymore. I'm jumping up to the early 50s, and I'm thinking of Gloria Alley, and I'm thinking of Ralph Meeker. And I'm thinking about Aldo Ray and Ralph Meeker, because I thought a lot when I was writing the book about actors who had gotten older as Walsh got older. They were his contemporaries. Cagney, Raft, who Walsh never had a great love for, because he was so much trouble on the set, behind the scenes. And actors of that generation, Bogey, who were getting older, and I was thinking about, well, they were younger actors coming up in the early 50s that Walsh became close with when he directed them, and they got along beautifully. Aldo Ray, Ralph Meeker, and I guess actors you would consider guys, you know, like tough guys, you know, not actors like Sal Mineo he worked with or Troy Donahue. But actors who were really in that masculine vein. And I am always sorry, not only that Walsh didn't work more often with John Wayne, but also that he only did one film with Ralph Meeker and worked so infrequently with Aldo Ray. Because I think this would have carried on the tradition had Walsh been able to exploit it in the best way possible. Yeah. So, because then you start thinking about actors like Wayne or actors who follow in that tradition and are cynical and very American in that sense, you know, because their conflict is within themselves, as is the conflict, you know, of the American character, the American Adam. The conflict is within yourself, there's not a conflict between you and society as there would be in European heroes.
Yeah. Well, when you say that Wayne's screen persona might have come out of a personal insecurity, probably can be said for 98.9% of all people who ever appeared in front of the camera. And I would say a lot of the people who directed films as well, because I think one of the things that we find so much in Walsh's generation of directors is... that they were so intent on being considered masculine guys, and they all considered show business to be a little bit of a soft industry. And I think Victor Fleming, certainly Clark Gable and Vic Fleming hung out together a lot. Wellman, Ford, Hawks was always, you know, racing motorcycles, and Henry King was always flying planes. They were all real, active, outdoorsy, go-getter kind of guys. And they all poo-pooed the idea that they were artists, because I think it made them uncomfortable to think that that they were somehow not as manly as they might be. And you see that a lot in especially that generation of
Bogey was a big men. One for that. And Walsh talks about it a lot in his autobiography. And Bogey was, I think, a little embarrassed sometimes about being an actor, although he certainly pursued it from I guess an older age than a lot of others. But he certainly pursued it on stage when he started out. But, you know, Walsh does talk about the fact that he's up there when they're doing High Sierra, and Bogey's up there complaining about the food that they send up to him up on the mount, and Walsh is saying, "What are you complaining about?" You know, he said that Bogey said, "I'm tired. I'm sitting up here all morning. I'm getting tired of waiting for this, that, and the other, and I can't stand this profession." And Walsh said, "I have to remind you what you're being paid." but Bogey was, that was a thing that Walsh always said about Bogey, and he called him Bogey the Beefer, because he always had a beef, you know. And even when they were on location and he'd be in a hotel room, or I should say in a motel room sometimes if they were up, you know, north. And he'd be complaining that, there was someone in the room next to him and they were, you know, a man and a woman were making too much noise. And he's always complaining, always complaining. And Walsh always had to bring him back down to earth and say, look at your salary. Yeah.
There was a little bit of that in Errol Flynn too, wasn't there? I mean, he was, always hard to get to the set. And I wonder if that wasn't a little bit of the same kind of thing that he felt that acting was an intrinsically silly profession, mm-hmm. and that his life was what was important, and that was...
Yes, but also he had aspirations to be a novelist, and he really was a wonderful writer. As I have an excerpt in my book of a memo that he wrote during production of, I believe it was Objective Burma.
Oh, yeah. It was hilarious, yeah.
Yeah, where he's complaining about the dressing room and that there are holes in the straw that they quickly put it together, you know, to make the walls of his dressing room, and how it was very difficult for him to have any privacy, and how it was infestation of all kinds of insects. And
it had been previously used as an outhouse, I believe he said.
Yes, or should be.
Yeah.
So he was, I don't know why, I think the reason he couldn't get to the set is because he was drinking.
Yeah.
That certainly wasn't Walsh's life. No matter how much he tried to present that, he really wasn't drinking all the time the way he liked to claim.
Yeah.
He'd like a good belt, but, you know, what he really liked more than anything was the camaraderie. I have wonderful stories in the book from people who worked with him in England when he did some not-so-wonderful films in England. Horatio Hornblower, which I think is a great film in its own way, but other films, smaller films that he did in England with Brian Forbes and the great art director, whose name escapes me at the moment, who got an Oscar. Well, anyway, I'll have to think about that. It's in my book. But... just these great stories of Walsh saying, okay, guys, let's go to the bar. And he wanted to hang out and drink, you know, not to get drunk, but to have, you know, this closeness with the crew. He loved the crew. He loved being around the crew. The actors, I don't think he was around as much as he was the crew. So, he really loved the guy thing of the camaraderie, which I have to also come back to and say that when he was making The Thief of Baghdad with Douglas Fairbanks, they got to be extremely close friends. And there's a great picture in my book of the two of them hanging out on a rope, you know, at the studios there on Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood. They had a great time together. And I think the reason that film succeeds, one of the reasons it succeeds, is Fairbanks was always flying off into this land of, you know, kind of a netherland, and Walsh was bringing him back with a sense of reality. So I think it was a great combination, although Walsh isn't often given credit for that film as much as I think he should.
I think it doesn't seem like a Walsh film to us for some reason, and I think it often comes as a kind of surprise when we remember that it's his, because it's not much like anything he ever did again in terms of that kind of fantasy, almost epic fantasy. It's an incredibly beautiful film and so much fun, too, just because Fairbanks was always so much fun.
And Walsh got along beautifully with William Cameron Menzies. Beautiful. They worked together before and after that film. Well, maybe not before, but no, I think they had worked together once before, but they became good friends whenever they did work together again. And Walsh really enjoyed the part of how am I going to get this effect? how am I going to do this? And, you know, his telling in his autobiography of how he rigged up the cables, you know, for the magic carpet, and how he was going by a construction site one day and thought, oh, look at that. You know, I can use this, I can use that. And he liked to figure out the logistics of things. And he did that also with figuring out the logistics of the end of White Heat. Mm. Of where was I going to shoot that, you know? And he was driving down in Wilmington one day and saw this, you know, this site, and said, yeah, that's pretty good, you know?
That's the big oil tankers that Cagney is on top of the world
on. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So he enjoyed the problem solving. But I think it's almost impossible to determine specifically where Walsh ended and Fairbanks began. You know, on one hand, you can see, if you look at all of the other of Fairbanks's films, you can see his great imagination at work. But I think Walsh was so good in Thief of Baghdad because he was invisible and gave the film so much that we can't, you know, pick out specifically. But the sense of being grounded is definitely his.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing also about Walsh, and you and I have talked about this before, that unlike some directors, I would say Ford is a prime example, Hitchcock, who had very distinctive styles, Walsh doesn't really have one. And so when you're looking for a directorial signature, it's harder to determine in a career like his.
His style was his swagger, his character's swagger, and the pace was his style, the quick pace, the humor that even quickened the pace, the humor. There was a great sense of humor there, bravado. And the thing about Walsh is that his characters always look very natural. Where I always say that George Stevens' characters always look very serious, and they're very believable. With Walsh's, they're not so much grounded in the real world, but they're believable in their heroism or their male. Even the women had male swagger, you know, and that's an energy. That's a kind of energy that you can identify always with Walsh. I mean, I got to the point where I could identify a film of his without knowing that it was his. You know, then what happens when you write a book on someone you know too much, and you can't ever do that again because you know the film the minute you see it. There goes the joy in it, in discovering.
Well, sometimes you just have to let it go fallow for a while and then go back. There was a time when I could have recited every Wellman film to you word for word and angle for angle, and some of them now I haven't seen for years. So it's like a new discovery when I do see them.
Yeah, that's nice when that happens.
Now, George Stevens, to my mind, could not be more different from Walsh.
They didn't even know each other.
They didn't? They never met?
They met, but they clearly, obviously, didn't hang out in the same circles.
Yeah.
Because George didn't hang out.
Yeah. Yes, Stevens does not seem to have been a very gregarious guy. Although the irony is, and I'd like to talk about this, and I hope we will in some depth, his early career is filled with just wonderfully funny, casual, just beautiful imagery. And then after the war, of course, he becomes this serious, almost totally humorless filmmaker. There are exceptions here and there, but not much.
Not many.
Not many. You really have to look for it. I mean, my God, I was watching Diary of Anne Frank the other day, and even Ed Wynn doesn't have a single laugh in the whole thing.
That's something.
It's just a completely serious. And, of course, it's a serious subject, but it's also you would think almost any other director would have found some lightness somewhere in the situation. And Stevens
there was a moment in The Diary of Anne Frank, but it's a tense moment also, and it's with the cat Mushi.
Yes,
who is causing havoc? Well, wreaking havoc when the police are downstairs, and everyone is, you know, of course, smashed against the floor, trying to keep quiet, and there's Mushi being a cat. I guess now that I think about it, it's not that humorous, but it's humorous in the way that that George created that sequence, because George liked to play around with film, and he ran the film backwards to get that wonderful effect of the cat putting his face in not the colander, with that the funnel, mm-hmm. putting his face in the funnel and almost knocking it off. I mean, there's a kind of perverse kind of humor in it, but it's also way too serious and dead and possibly deadly consequences that might result. But no, yes. No and yes. Yes before the war and no after. The sense of humor was before the war.
Wasn't Diary of Anne Frank the movie that got you interested in George Stevens?
When I was a kid, I saw it and right away loved the story. Had read the book, loved the story, and walked out of the theater even as a kid wondering, who made that film? And I had wanted to... Well, I knew I loved George Stevens, and it's really odd for a kid, especially a girl in this culture, I think, to like walk around loving a director. You think, I would have loved Bette Davis, which I did. But... I always was interested in George Stevens, and the name just kind of was magical for me. And when I was finishing my PhD in literature, when I was at USC, I decided I wanted to do a biography of George Stevens. And one of my professors, who thought that Stevens was completely unworthy of any kind of sustained work, wrote me a letter so that I thought I needed it to get into the Academy Library, which was then on Wilshire. And that was when I began. And then I was too busy with my doctorate. And after I finished my doctorate and worked at film magazines, I worked at Box Office and Hollywood Reporter, I thought, you know what, I'm going to start the Stevens biography again. I guess I was watching more of his films. Not that there are that many. There are only about 25, major films. And I thought, okay, I'm going to start this biography. And that was when I contacted George Jr. to tell him. And he was delighted to think that somebody was going to do an academic book on Stevens. And then, of course, it changed into a little more than an academic book. There is a lot of biography in it and a lot of production material in it. Because when I got to the Academy Library and learned quickly that George Stevens has the largest collection of any single person at the library, and I don't know if it's larger than Katharine Hepburn's, because that's a recent acquisition. But at any rate... So I decided to go full throttle in, and I sat there for 5 years looking at his stuff, and there's a lot of stuff, and because Stevens kept everything. What always amazes me, and this is something that Walsh never had, was Stevens and Hepburn, because I'm looking at the Hepburn collection now, was the sense of themselves as legendary, that they were on their way to being legendary, that what they were doing was important, and it was going to be looked at after they died. They knew it. And I know Hemingway had this. Hemingway would keep grocery lists, but Stevens kept everything, Christmas cards, same thing with Hepburn.
Oh.
And so Stevens' collection was very, very, a very long situation to get finished. I don't know if I even got to everything. But at any rate... yes, the early films, and for me, everything about Stevens, everything significant about Stevens stems from his work with Oliver and with Laurel and Hardy, and especially Stan Laurel, who taught him that comedy could be graceful, as it is said in the documentary that George Jr. made about his father. And Stevens took from what he learned and used it throughout his career, even in something as serious as The Diary of Anne Frank. There was always some form of slapstick, because it was never slapstick to him. It was human comedy, the human condition. I hate that expression, but it's true. The human situation. It is Laurel and Hardy. The very, you know, kernel of it is Laurel and Hardy doing something to each other and then looking back to see what the response of the other person was, which immediately creates a bond between them. And then you have the audience looking at this, and this creates a bond between them and the audience, and everybody is kind of bonded, you know. And there's a caring that exists between them, despite the horrible things that are done between them. Or to each other.
Well, they fight.
Befall them.
They fight like children among themselves.
Yeah.
But there's never any malice, you know, toward them.
Now, there's always that look back. Are
yeah.
you okay?
One of the reasons I've always loved them is because they loved each other.
Yeah.
And it's very clear that they do. Is a reason I've never had much fondness for Abbott and Costello is because they can be funny, but they clearly hate each other. And the characters hate each other. We'll do bad things to each other just to do it. And for some reason, that's always rubbed me the wrong way. But Laurel and Hardy, there's clearly a bond. And that wonderful formality with each other, that this is my friend Mr. Laurel and I'm Mr. Hardy. You know? They're very genteel men in very bad situations. But
yes.
I can see where Stevens would take a lot out of that. That's more than comedy.
I think he took it because it appealed to him so immediately, and it was so a part of something already in him.
Yeah.
And so he latched onto it because it felt right. I think the way he was raised, in a gentle kind of way, and this is, of course, the famous story of his mother giving him his first Brownie camera at age 7 or 9. I think it was age 7, 8, or 9. And it's a long time since the book. And if you look at some of the pictures, some of the photographs he took, they're amazing, because he was a true photographer. He had a true eye for composition, even as a child. And you can see some of the images in Shane go right back to these early pictures that he took up in Northern California and Seattle. And I think that's the way he was raised. And what's always amazed me about Stevens is his incredible sense of knowing what he wanted and knowing who he was. This self-confidence that was always there. And my favorite story about that is I was talking to Malvin Wald, brother of Jerry Wald, because I had considered doing some work on Jerry Wald after the Stevens book. And Malvin Wald, who was still alive at the time, and therefore talking to me, thank goodness he was, said that he believed that we got on a conversation Harry Cohen, and he said Harry Cohen killed
Columbia Pictures,
Columbia, and he said Harry Cohen killed my brother, you know, caused his final heart attack, gave him such a hard time. And I thought, well, that's very interesting, because Stevens' experience with Cohen was just the opposite. Like Capra, when Stevens got to Columbia, which he did 3 pictures at right before he left for World War II for Europe, he told Cohen in no uncertain terms right away that he was not allowed on his set. And if he was going to come on his set, Stevens would just stop working. He didn't want him anywhere near him. And that was it. And I thought, well, what an interesting, you know, combination of reactions to somebody who could be difficult. And Stevens was not bowled over by anything that Cohen had to offer him. And he did probably his 3 funniest comedies and most human comedies, I guess you would say, yeah, at Columbia. I'm trying to think of what came before. And, you know, these are straight out and out comedies. And, well, two. two comedies, because one, of course, was at MGM, Woman of the Year, which Stevens didn't like being at MGM, because he knew immediately that MGM was a producer studio, and he didn't want anything to do with that. First was The Talk of the Town at Columbia. And actually, he got there earlier, but The Talk of the Town was a comedy at Columbia in the few years before his leaving the U.S. to go work for Eisenhower's photographic unit in Europe during the war. But he was pulled over to MGM by Katharine Hepburn. She wanted him because she was doing Woman of the Year. She was very involved with the script, as she always was. And she thought George was the perfect director. She didn't want Cukor at that time. She wanted someone who was more masculine for this film. And
should have called Walsh.
Not that masculine. Yeah, no, I don't know if Walsh would have been the wrong guy for this material. This was real sophisticated. Walsh was so much better with the raw stuff, you know, the stuff that sounded raw, even though it was, you know, perfected for a year any actor ever laid eyes on it. But so he went over to MGM and knew that he wasn't going to be there past this film. Then went back to Columbia for The More the Merrier, which is one of my favorite of his comedies. And you see a lot of Laurel and Hardy in that. You see the mistaken identity, you know, the quips back and forth, the wonderful Joel McRae talking with the wonderful Charles Coburn, who I did learn later on was a reactionary right winger, but that's okay. Anyway, so the wonderful quips, the wordplay, and the gags, the gag with Charles Coburn's pants, with the suspenders that fly out the window and then they get buried under the covers, and it's just that's all Laurel and Hardy stuff, and just gave the film a great human quality. And it was silent. It was silently done. Because Stevens always believed the film should be silent. He always believed that. And even though he was, you know, having no trouble changing to talkies when the time called for it, but he always thought that the beauty of film was in its silence. You know, in its action. He called it the pictorial sense. So then, of course, he goes to Europe and takes along his home movies, his camera to do home movies in color, and they are among the first ever taken of the war. And he logs in and keeps a log of everywhere he went, including the Battle of the Bulge and D-Day. He was there. He was there for all the big events, getting more and more depressed, even before they ended up at Dachau. Because before they ended up at Dachau, they were at Buchenwald. And that was very depressing to see the people there. This is before the war ended. But then when the war was just ending and they ended up at Dachau, that, I think, destroyed him destroyed a certain part of him. And he never really truly thought anything was funny ever again. But he said on his return, he said it made film seem less important and more important. Because what he thought he was doing when he was in the war was, he also kept a diary, a journal. And what he thought he was doing was taking pictures as a record to send to the bereaved families back home who had lost their loved ones. And in that way, I in the book, I do equate him with Whitman, because Whitman was writing poems for families, for people who had suffered during the war. He was very involved in the Civil War.
That color footage that Stephen shot at the concentration camps is so much more horrifying, because we're not used to seeing it. We've always had the distance of black and white. As horrible as it is to see that those images in black and white, when you see them looking like it's happening right now, it's soul changing, you can't even begin to grasp what it would be like to actually be there. And I certainly understand how he could come back totally changed like that. It's it seems churlish to say I regret what it did to his film, his film sense, but I certainly understand it. I mean, I can't imagine not being profoundly altered by that experience.
But then it gave us a place in the sun, which I think is my very favorite of his films.
It's a wonderful film, and Shane is, you know, I go back and forth on Shane a little bit, but by and large, I love it. There's a certain, the formality of it sometimes works against it to me because, I guess, just because I feel like a Western should be a little bit more dusty and
Walsh
rugged.
Love dust.
Yes. But, nevertheless, it's a wonderful film.
But we often forget that Stephen started out in the West. He started out on the landscape, photographing. That was where his, and knowing the Native Americans just as Walsh did, becoming very close with them. So he started at that, and he always wanted to get back. He didn't like doing what he called parlor films any more than Walsh did, but he did them because he saw the human comedy in them, you know, and he liked having his sense of humor, I think. But he always wanted to get back and always meant to get back.
Yeah.
He always wanted to do a great tragedy. That was always something that was important to him. And he was looking for that always. And especially after the war, he wanted to find a great tragedy. And that was Dreiser for him. Because nobody more tragic than Dreiser. You know?
It's even the name of the book.
Even the name of the book, An American Tragedy. And he fought hard to get that made, that film made. He just fought them and... Oh, the meetings were endless, and luckily Al, his good friend, and Thorne in his side, best buddy, Ivan Moffat was around when I was writing the book, and Ivan told me so many wonderful moments about those meetings at Paramount, trying to get them to do Place in the Sun, because they had done another version, von Sternberg's version, of An American Tragedy in 1931, and they were really... nicked by that. They were burned, and they didn't want to do it again. And
it
Siemens
was not successful at the box office, was it?
It wasn't successful on any level, really, because Dreiser hated it.
Yeah.
He wrote the screenplay, and then they just tossed it, and he sued them. Oh, he sued them. He did not like that film.
Well, it's a von Sternberg film, which means that it's gorgeous to look at and has problems... in every other aspect. But Sylvia Sidney's terrific in it, and it has good stuff.
As she is in everything. But the irony of it is that Stevens took this great, massive indictment of American capitalism and turned it into a love story. And that's a very interesting thing to talk about very briefly, because I think... he did that for several reasons. Number one, he really wanted a box office hit, but he still wanted art. But he wanted something that young people could identify with. And in those days, Shelley Winters and Elizabeth Taylor were the epitome of young. And Montgomery Clift, he referred to them as the kids, you know, kids, mm-hmm. that kids could identify with. And Stevens always liked a love story. And that was not a love story. But he turned it into one. But he made it into his own film. And he made it into something he thought was a love story that inadvertently is a great tragedy. But I also don't think that Stevens, despite his great intellect, was the intellect, the cold intellect that Dreiser was.
Yeah.
And I think he did with it what he could, but he also had to work with Paramount. And he had to make a box office success. But the tragedy in it is, I think, not always known to its maker.
Yeah. It's also such an interesting film visually. Stevens used close-ups like nobody else ever used them that I can think of. And it's A Place in the Sun is not the first time he does this. It shows up in a lot of the other films. Gunga Din, there are a lot of scenes where the close-ups of those characters are different than any other director would have done them. I mean, just...
How do you think they're different? That's interesting.
For one thing, closer. He went really close. I'm hard-pressed to come up with another example. The scene in Gunga Din I'm thinking of is when they think the attack is coming, but they know something's wrong, and each of the three principals, Cary Grant, Doug Fairbanks Jr., and Victor McLaughlin, are listening. And the camera comes in, and it's touching the tips of their noses. And in Place in the Sun, the same thing is the case. But in that case, it's these very lyrical. It's almost like he plays with the speed of the film or something.
Yes.
I don't know what he was doing there.
Well, clearly he does that with Anne Frank, but In Place in the Sun, yes, he was doing the old Stevens thing again of running it backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards until he got the rhythm that he wanted. But yeah, this is very kind of paradoxical in when you're looking at these two characters, Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift, and you're almost thinking that you're intruding on them. And yet it's so inviting. And I think the largeness of it, because it's so close, makes it larger than just two people. I called it in my book, I See America Kissing, mm-hmm. because it was like a Whitman poem. It was so large that it encompassed so much cultural stuff that these two people are kissing in this close-up. Because the film was so conscious of its cultural trappings, I think, and the social trappings. That's really what the subject of the Dreiser's story is.
Well, we quite literally have no distance from these characters. No. And because visually we have no distance from them, and emotionally we don't either. We're right there.
Plus also Stevens, I think, was a little in love with Liz Taylor, as his camera was.
Gosh, who wouldn't be?
One of Cliff's early biographers refers to them as the two most beautiful people in the world.
I'd buy that.
Yeah.
I'd buy that.
At that stage, they were. She was 17.
Yeah.
When she made that. But both of, well, Montgomery Clift was not a fan of Stevens, but Liz Taylor really was. And she thought she learned the seriousness of her craft from Stevens, as most people who worked with him thought.
Yeah.
Just not Montgomery Clift.
When Liz Taylor was getting her AFI Life Achievement Award, I wrote the piece for the program, as I did for 10 years or so, all those things. Mm-hmm. And the editor sent back my first draft and said, "You've got to stop saying beautiful so much." I realized, how can you not say it in every sentence? I mean, you just... It's overwhelming. She's just so perfect in so many ways.
Her face.
Yeah.
I don't know about her body, though.
Yeah.
It got funny later.
Speaking of this, the visual sense that Stevens has made me think of something I thought of a while ago, that he started out as a cameraman, and I wanted to ask you, did you get the sense that he wanted to be a cameraman, or was that always a means to an end?
When he started out, he just wanted a job. He knew he wanted this. What happened was he had been pulled away. He was in the theater when he was growing up in San Francisco. His father was an actor and had a theater troupe. But then movies came and put his father out of business. And you can see his father as... The father of Fred Astaire's fiance in Swing Time. Betty Furness's father is played by George Stevens' father.
Really?
Yes.
Why didn't I know that?
Yeah, I don't know. And he's a very handsome man and very melodramatic, and he has a few minutes in the film. But he was pulled away because his father said, I can't continue this, so we have to go down to Los Angeles because I've got to get a job as an extra. I've got to get work. I have, you know, two kids, and I got to do something here. So they went down, and Stevens had to quit to high school. And he did go to the Glendale Library and kind of complete his education on his own. But he then started to make a living as a photographer. He would take photographs of people and storefronts in Glendale and sell them back to the customers, and they bought them. And he became very interested. But then, of course, there was this fever going around, and that was to be in the movies. And Stevens literally talked about jumping fences to go into the backyard of some production company that showed up for a couple of days and then dissolved, and then there'd be another one. And he would just jump fences, and he would get jobs at production companies. And finally, he was hired, I believe, I think it might have been Warner Brothers very early on, but not for very long. He wanted to work in the movies. And he learned, I don't think it was only as a cameraman, I think that was what he knew. That was how he started. But he really loved the business. He loved the movie fever. He had the movie fever. And he, like Walsh, he was, even though maybe a generation behind Walsh, I mean, born in the end of 1904 as to Walsh's 1887, but he learned everything on the spot. And he learned to write it, cut it, photograph it, and everything at once, and he just became one of those directors who learned it from the ground up. And he got his first serious job with Rex the Devil Horse at Hal Roach.
Sure.
And he started out as a photographer, but I think he just wanted to be in the business because he already knew about acting. He was on stage or behind stage, you know, backstage when his father was acting. So he wanted all of it. He wanted all of it. Even though, you know, different than Walsh. Walsh started out as an actor, per se. Stevens just loved the business. And his father didn't want him to go into it, seriously, because he thought it was okay for his father to do odd jobs, you know, because he had to make a living, and someday he'd get back to the theater where, you know, the real prestige was. But he did not think it was a legitimate profession. So he couldn't tell his father when he first got jobs. And then he finally broke it to him.
There's always such a visual elegance to Stevens films. And is it simplistic to say that's because he was a photographer himself, that he really just had an eye for how he wanted things shot?
I think partly. But also Stevens really had a sense of himself as a spokesperson for a cultural dialogue about this country. And I think people don't get that about Stevens a lot. And that was why he was so easily moving between genre, you know. He could do a musical, I have to say, probably better than Walsh was able to do them at the beginning, you know. Well, probably Stevens had better material. Mm. I shouldn't say that, but that might be true. But he was able to swing back and forth between any genre because he really had a view of how characters and the setting they were in were really symbolic of the culture around him. And I think he had a large sense of this country. And again, because he was a cameraman, the pictorial sense was important to him. So you're right in that respect, yes. But the character's relationship to the environment is always very important to Stevens, and we really see that in Shane.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking earlier, of course, Swing Time, which is one of the best Astaire Rogers films. And all of the Astaire Rogers films are beautifully shot, but nothing quite like Swing Time, which is exquisitely shot. And Fred Astaire very famously always wanted to be shot head to toe because, quite rightly, he figured I'm dancing. You should see what's going on, which is something that I really regret that nobody seems to understand anymore about how to shoot dance. Because they all feel like they need to edit it. But instead you should let people dance and photograph that. But that the final number, Never Gonna Dance, that the camera is always perfectly there for what the dance needs them to be, but it's also almost this just virtuosic choreography in and of itself of where the camera is moving and how it's swooping in and out and how it's always with them, but it's more than just that. It's more than just documenting.
It's part of the storytelling.
Doing. Yeah,
it's telling. It's the sadness of the characters. But you know, I always like to say I always like to repeat what Hermes Pan told Stevens, being that this was his first of only two musicals. Or two and a half, because he did, the Joan Fontaine. That's a whole other story. Damsel in Distress. Yes. After this, but this Hermes Pan just said to Stevens, "Okay, kid, just make sure you get his about Fred Astaire. Make sure you get his feet in. You know, make sure you get the feet in the in the frame. That's what you got to do."
There's wonderful stuff in Damsel in Distress. For one thing, I think it captures the spirit of P.G. Wodehouse better than most films of the time ever did. And it's got George and Gracie in it, and it's got Fred Astaire, and it's got wonderful stuff. But Joan Fontaine sinks that thing like a rock.
Yeah. And I'll tell you a good story about that. Fred Astaire, who was always gracious, saw what was happening and wanted her out. He said, "This is awful. She's ruining this film. We have to get her out." And Steven said, "We can't, because she is so fragile." He must have learned this from Gunga Din. She is so fragile, and also the film he did with her before Gunga Din, Quality Street. Mm. She is so fragile that if we do this, it'll destroy her. If we get rid of her, it'll destroy her, and we have to keep her in.
Wow.
Yeah.
That could be the only time that sentence was ever said in the history of Hollywood.
So his sense was that they would recover. But she wouldn't.
Wow.
So he tried to camouflage her by putting trees in front of her and all kinds of things.
That number that they do together is, it's almost laughable in that he is clearly just putting things so that we don't see her.
And
they're dancing down the lane behind these trees and we just don't see her. It's so obvious that that's what's happening. I can't imagine what that did to her fragile ego if when she saw that.
But I shouldn't say that he learned this. Gunga Din was after this film. This film
no.
was...
Yeah, it was.
I
it
shouldn't
was.
Have said
yeah,
that.
Gunga Din was 39. Yeah,
maybe he just learned that. Well, I think Quality Street, let's see, what year is Damsel in Distress? Is it 36, 37?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he did Quality Street, I think, before.
35?
I think around then, yeah. Because I no longer remember. It's been so many years since I've looked at anything. But he got a sense, either intuitively or from some other source, that she was going to fall apart and have a nervous breakdown.
Wow.
And I don't think she ever knew that he said that.
Well, she certainly always came across like that in her portrayals, but I guess maybe that's where
it
came from.
I get the sense she's not like that.
Yeah. Interesting.
I mean, she's not Rebecca.
Yeah.
or you know, the character in Suspicion. I don't think that's her. But I wouldn't know. But so she, that was...
You tried to interview her for the Stevens book, right?
Yeah, she... And you know what? She was not talking at the time, and... I was so in love with all the production stuff, and when I found more interviews than I ever thought I would. And I knew that they had had an affair, and I didn't really want to play that up, and I knew that's what she would probably talk about, because she did talk about that stuff. But yes, they did probably have something going on. Stevens was, although a serious guy, he got around.
Yeah.
So, I know he and Catherine Hepburn had something. And because the wife, Stephen's wife, knew it immediately when they were on the set of Alice Adams. And that was very shortly after their marriage, like 5 years after. So.
Well.
Yeah.
Ah, directors, what are you going to do?
I mean, you get someone like Stephens, and I mean, being a female, I got to say, I can see where they would, you run into someone who is kind of like your father figure, and he's in charge of everything, and if you're any kind of, if you're like most people who are broken to begin with, and as you say, actors, then you're insecure, and you run up against someone who isn't. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't seem to be, then, you get seduced by that.
Yeah, that's the story of Hollywood.
And I know from knowing Catherine Hepburn as well, as little or well as I know her now, she was quite insecure too and covered it up beautifully.
Yeah.
So.
We're running out of time, but I still want to talk a little bit about the greatest story ever told, because to me, such a colossal misstep. And I think we've talked about this before, but the cameos that he studs the film with, all these famous Hollywood names who come in for one scene, or in some cases one line, seems like such a distraction when you see it, and it almost turns it into a kind of trivia game. Was this against Stephen's will,
no.
Or did he want to do that?
He was advised to do it by
for
the
box
studio
office reasons,
and he fell into it. He allowed himself to, whereas I think before he would not have. But I think that he was over his head with this film, with the subject matter, from the beginning, and I think. He just
It's a problematic
slowly,
story to get on screen anyway.
And it's so grandiose that you see where he's going after the war, where this had to be where he was going. this had to be fate, was such that he was aspiring to this kind of grandiosity. And you see it in A Place in the Sun. You see that things become very, very serious, and he's dealing with American culture and cultural myths and American society, which is a much bigger subject than he had dealt with before the war, because he wanted to. He really wanted to do serious things. And then you see him in Shane, and you see he's with those grand titans, and you see that things are getting out of hand almost, that the people are just dwarfed by this, or just stunted by this physicality around them. And he's taking on the myth of the gunslinger, and that's a large myth, and you see him getting bigger and bigger, and in terms of his thematic concerns, until he reaches the ultimate goal, whether or not he knew it, which was the greatest story ever told. And he made a lot of bad choices. He erred many times over and lost control, I think, of his film in terms of the weather, in terms of the time. And when it started out, don't forget, it took about 3 or 4 years to make that film. And then Stephens always edited for at least a year. When he started out, the biblical film in this country had a much different reputation than when he actually finished.
Yeah.
And the audience was no longer there. And then there was that Time or Life magazine thing, Is God Dead? There was that was something he always remembered seeing. And I think that God was dead to a certain extent by the time he was done with this film. But he got in so over his head that they had to have, David Lean come in and direct some of the sequences. And what's interesting, and there's a book called Hollywood Holy Land, which discusses the fact that Stevens actually built a city
yes.
for the set to get this film made.
Yeah, it was such an undertaking that it's mind-boggling in a way. But also in the early to mid-60s, it was that prime time of big all-star casts. And they loved to have 50 names in the credits. And Mad World, The Longest Day, it just goes on and on.
Which is a good film.
Yeah, and so it just seems like this is part of that tradition. But in this case, you know, John Wayne is the centurion. We talked earlier about how much I revere John Wayne. This is not his finest moment.
But it's a brief one.
Yeah, it's brief. And he's not bad in it. You know, I mean, it's not like he does it badly. It's just, boom, hey, wait a minute, it's John Wayne. And there can't be a single human on earth who wasn't taken out of the movie at that moment.
And the irony is that every actor wanted to work with Stevens.
Yeah.
Because they considered it to be the best thing that their career could ever have is to work with Stevens. And even Wayne thought that.
Yeah.
Because they were not close, you know. But the irony also is that Stevens wanted this to be so beautifully visually, which it is. And he wanted it to follow art, you know, paintings of the subject, religious paintings, and it did, and it's stilted for that reason because it's the most beautiful film I think he's ever done. And I also, ironically and sadly, the only time he got film credit for writing when he was also a writer, mm-hmm. which few people knew, but John Ford knew that Stevens. You know, people who worked with John Ford, and one in particular said, Stevens is a writer. He will tell the screenwriter what to say and where to say it. And he never got credit for it on screen, but unfortunately for this film he did. Yeah.
It's, well...
But it's still a beautiful film.
It's a little bit like that screenplay that Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks did, The Taming of the Shrew, and mm-hmm. says... based on the play by William Shakespeare, additional dialogue by, in this case, yeah. Based on the book by God.
God, yeah. Yes. God.
Additional dialogue by George Stevens.
Well, Carl, and Carl, the poet. Yeah. Anyway, the poet laureate who was there. Carl Sandburg, thank you. They became good friends. And a very, very beautiful story of their friendship and the last time that they saw each other, because he used to go out to Sandberg's house. But Sandberg came and never wrote a word, but was on salary. Never wrote a word, came to story meetings and would always claim to be cold and would walk out with someone's jacket that was loaned to him to put over his knees and collected a closet full of jackets. And he did not return.
Wow. Well, at least he got something out of The Greatest Story Ever Told, if nobody else did.
Yes.
So it was a pretty big flop, wasn't it? I mean, it never...
Yes.
Never really made it. That being said, I wish somebody would show a 70mm print of it. I would love to see... I think the only way you can actually fairly judge it in any way is to see it in the way it was meant to be shown.
What's interesting is that... Just the way The Big Trail flopped, this film started out as a 20th century box. You could say it was like the 1965 version of Grandeur that almost flopped 20th century Fox, except that Cleopatra did that for everyone, which was also going on at the time. The studio was having a little trouble with money.
Wow. Well,
so he got it over to UA.
Yeah, all that stuff nearly sank Fox, but at least it gave us Saturday Night at the Movies.
Yes.
Which turned out to be good for all of us nascent film buffs who were kids at the time.
So. Yes, that's right. It's true.
Well, I think we've run out of time. You're working on a book on Douglas Sirk now.
Yes.
And that's a really fascinating subject. So
yes.
Let's get together again when
Absolutely.
You've done that, and we'll do this all over
Absolutely.
Again. Absolutely. Thanks, Marilyn.
You're so welcome.
You.
It was fun.
Okay, I'll share a weird story with you. You know, I told you before the interview began about the weird thing with my memory card, how I got home and there was nothing on the card, and then weeks later I found the interview on the same card. Well, in this case, I record my ins and outs on that self-same memory card, and you make a different, it's called a project on the Zoom recorder. So in this case, project number two was my intro, and then project number three was my outro. And I recorded it once again, saw everything bouncing around, and the volume thing was going, the footage was moving, and everything was Jake. And then when I put it in the computer, there was nothing there. Now, this is the only time this has ever happened to me, and it both has to do with my podcast with Marilyn Moss. So you tell me, some sort of strange supernatural occurrence? I think so. I think that's really the only logical explanation. Anyway, beyond that weirdness, and suddenly there's a chill in the room. I don't know exactly how to account for that. But I hope you enjoyed the talk anyway. I know I did. I enjoyed listening to it very much the second time. I hope that we'll have Marilyn on again when she completes her book on Douglas Sirk, because that's an interesting subject. And in fact, Marilyn is, even as we speak at this moment, which is May 19th, 2014, she is in Europe working on that Douglas Sirk book, and so I'm looking forward to reading that. She has also nearly completed her documentary on Raoul Walsh, which was just a gleam in her eye when we did this interview, and so I am eager to see that. As always, I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, for being my great announcer, not only on this, but on my new podcast, The Commentary Track Presents Radio Movies. Why don't you click on the Amazon link and go into Amazon and buy yourself some books or DVDs or Blu-rays or CDs or anything, socks, anything, because Amazon has everything. And we get a little bit of a kickback if you go through the website, and there's a little portal. You'll see it. It's very as big as the nose on your face right there. Just click on the Amazon link and go on in. And I would suggest, in addition to buying books and CDs and so forth, that you also buy everything there. I would suggest a nuclear submarine would be good. Perhaps a dog sled, ski poles, perhaps a yurt. I'd really urge you to buy that nuclear sub, because that would be probably several billion dollars, and the kickback from that would be substantial. I would really enjoy that. And you'd have a nuclear sub. It's win-win. Come on, people. Help me out here. I also want to thank my webmaster, James Hutchins, for designing my two websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Please visit them early and often. Also want to thank the enormously gifted Rob Clearfield and the clear genius Gary Rand for writing my theme music fore and aft. Love it every week. And I want to thank you for spreading the word, telling others about the podcasts. Please listen to them both. It's fun. There's no work involved. It's just enjoyment. So I hope that you'll spread the word, tell all your friends, tell all your family, tell friends of your family, and tell the family of your friends. Tell everybody. Get up on the big wide world. What do they call that big wide world thing? I guess it's called the intranet. Go on that thing and tell people about it. Because the more we listen, the happier I will be. And don't you want me to be happy? I want you to be happy. Come on, give back a little bit. Don't be so selfish. Jeez. Hope you'll join me again next week. And it's going to be a good one. And until then, please don't worry. We'll fix it in post.